Phil Picardi here on Friday, May 10th, here with the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Today on the podcast, high-fiving and hand-wringing outside the Minnesota House yesterday. The chamber passed a bill legalizing same-sex marriage. We'll hear about that. Also, the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra makes a triumphant return to the stage. The U does deals with Fairview and the Vikings. And ready, set, fish. Same-sex marriage is a big step closer to being legal in Minnesota. The State House voted 75-59 to pass the bill yesterday. The House's action makes it all but certain same-sex couples will be able to marry starting August 1st in this state. But as Tom Scheck reports, groups on both sides of the issue are already eyeing the political fallout.
Supporters who gathered outside of the House chamber erupted in cheers after the vote. DFL House leaders who both supported the bill and ensured its passage were treated like rock stars after they left the House chamber. DFL Representative Steve Simon of St. Louis Park told a packed Capitol rotunda that their work was almost done.
It's not time to uncork the champagne yet, but it's chilling. It is chilling.
The bill now moves to the Senate for a scheduled Monday vote. It's all but certain to pass, and a spokesman for Governor Dayton says Dayton plans to sign it as soon as the next day. But even as supporters celebrated, DFL legislative leaders and others were already worrying about the political ramifications of the vote. DFL House Speaker Paul Thiessen reminded the audience that a lot of rural Democrats and suburban Republicans took a risky political stand.
We have a lot of people who stood up today to do the right thing, and we are going to need to stand with them in the future as they go back to their communities.
Some Republicans and Democrats acknowledged during and after the debate that their votes could have political consequences. DFL Representative Tim Faust of Hinckley told the House that a majority in his district voted last November for the constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. He said many who oppose same-sex marriage cite scripture. But Faust, a Lutheran pastor, said he kept asking himself, who has the right to impose their religious beliefs on others?
And so today we have the opportunity to give a part of our population, fellow brothers and sisters of God, the same rights that most of us have taken for granted.
There were four Republicans who bucked their party and voted for the bill. Jennifer Loon of Eden Prairie, David Fitzsimmons of Albertville, Pat Garofalo of Farmington, and Andrea Kiefer of Woodbury. All of them said an amendment that strengthened protections for religious institutions gave them more comfort to back the bill. Fitzsimmons said he offered the amendment to ease concerns about religious freedom.
This bill had 71 Democrat votes. It needed 68 to pass. It had plenty to pass, with or without us. And I will stand by that. What we did was everything we could to protect people's right of conscience and to protect people's religious beliefs and their religious institutions.
None of the Republicans who voted for the bill said they were worried that their votes would cause them political problems in the future. But there are groups paying attention. Richard Carlbaum, campaign manager for the pro-same-sex marriage group Minnesotans United, said his organization will have to work to ensure some of those members get reelected.
We're going to get down to business and get down to work on Tuesday after the Senate passes this, and we're going to figure out how to make sure that the folks who stood on the right side of history have the support they need to continue to stand on principle and vote their conscience.
On the other side of the issue, John Helmberger, CEO of the Minnesota Family Council, acknowledged there's little his organization can do to stop the bill from becoming law. But he said they'll start working on efforts to repeal it with a focus on the governor's race and the House in 2014. Helmberger said he was particularly disappointed in the Republicans and rural Democrats who backed the bill.
If what you're asking is, are we thinking about affecting change in the legislature and the governor's office? Yes. But that will be a long-term proposition. It'll be 4 years before the Senate is up for re-election, or 3 years. So we know that will be a long-term effort.
One Republican senator, Brandon Peterson of Andover, has said he'll vote for the bill. It isn't clear whether other senators from his party will join him.
Tom Scheck at the state capitol. Same-sex marriage has dominated Minnesota politics for 2 years now, and thousands of people filled the Capitol Rotunda yesterday. Sasha Aslanian was among the throngs.
As supporters of the marriage bill chanted equal rights, the Holt children, their ears packed with Kleenex, did their best to outshout them. Their mother, Mary Lou Holt of Corcoran, brought 6 of her 8 children to protest the bill's passage.
I believe children need mothers and fathers, and I think the state sanctioning of marriage to be something that excludes women, that would exclude mothers, is wrong.
Holt and her family stood at the center of the rotunda, just feet away from people who support gay marriage. Another opponent, Ernest Lowe Jr. of St. Paul, strode through the rotunda shouting in every direction. Patty Taylor of St. Paul was holding a sign in support of the bill.
Say no! In the name of Jesus,
say no. And I'm saying yes in the name of Jesus.
This is why we should say no.
I'm a proud Catholic saying yes, yes, yes.
Minnesota for Marriage, a group trying to defeat the bill, held regular prayer circles throughout the day.
Reveal your will, Lord. If anyone is confused about marriage, that it is a man and a woman that you institute in creation with Adam and Eve.
Faith leaders on the other side, from Clergy United for All Families, prayed and sang. After 3 hours of singing, praying, chanting, and cheering outside the House chamber, lawmakers finished their speeches inside and took a vote. Crowds made up mostly of supporters huddled around video monitors. They watched as green yes votes and red no votes lit up the board. 75 green lights told them gay marriage had passed. For same-sex marriage supporters, it was a reversal of fortune from 2 years ago when opponents put the marriage amendment on the general election ballot. Back then, it looked like Minnesota might become the 31st state to prohibit same-sex marriage in its constitution. Now, it could become the 12th state to legalize it. Tim Sneer of Hopkins, who hopes to marry his partner of 24 years, described it as a roller coaster of a day.
I wouldn't have missed it for anything.
Both sides will be back on Monday when the Senate takes its vote. Sasha Aslanian, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Sasha Aslanian on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. State lawmakers have passed legislation that would ban the box. The phrase refers to a checkbox on employment applications where job seekers are asked if they have a criminal history. Annie Baxter says the legislation forbids most private employers from asking about a job candidate's criminal background in the early stages of the hiring process.
Bruce Craig has been out of prison for 10 years, but when it comes to his job prospects, he says it's as though he never left. Employers often pass him over right away because of his past felonies.
It still haunts me 10 years later.
Craig's rap sheet includes serious crimes, rape, forgery, and theft. But he says he's a changed man. He's sorry for his crimes, and he's tried to improve himself. In prison, he says he took college courses. He'd like to explain all that to potential employers.
If you're an employer, I need you in my network. So I come out and I spill my guts. I tell you about me and where I've been right up front.
But many employers would reject Craig automatically based on a job application, specifically the little box one checks to indicate run-ins with the law. New legislation could prop open a door for people like Bruce Craig. State and local government agencies in Minnesota are already forbidden from inquiring into a person's criminal background until the interview or job offer stage. Now, that likely will be the case for many private employers, too.
Far too often, employers are not providing these individuals with a chance even to interview for a job.
Kevin Lindsay is the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. His office would investigate potential violations of the law. Some employers, like daycare providers, will be automatically exempt. Lindsay says he respects employers' needs to decide how much risk they want to take on in hiring someone with a sketchy past. In the more extreme situations where a candidate has a violent past, Lindsay acknowledges employers have a tough call to make. But he says most crimes are nonviolent, and regardless of the offense,
let's at least entertain and have the conversation, as opposed to making it a categorical no for that individual.
Starting in 2014, Lindsay's office will issue warnings to employers who are found to have prematurely screened out candidates based on their criminal backgrounds. If the companies don't shape up, they get fined up to $500 per violation. Then, in 2015, there are no more warnings before fines hit. The maximum fines will be scaled to the size of the employer. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce took a neutral position on the legislation approved by the House this week. The chamber spokesman Ben Gerber says he's glad the bill shields private employers from civil lawsuits over how they consider applicants' criminal backgrounds. But Gerber says employers will still have to deal with some costs. He says that will most likely be the case if an employer has to rewrite a job application.
A lot of times, even small employers will have an employment attorney review it. And so if they're going to take something off, they're still going to want to make sure they're compliant with it. And so, that was still a concern for a lot of our members.
For other employers who already save the criminal background questions for the interview phase, the costs will be less cumbersome. Bruce Craig, the ex-felon, says he understands why employers would want to know about the past of someone like him, but he also wants to work. He says he doesn't want to be reliant on government handouts, and he says he needs a job for his own dignity.
If I ever get it in my head that I am not worth hiring, I give up, and I do things that are not healthy for me or anybody else.
Craig is happy about the ban the box legislation, but is keeping his expectations in check about what it will mean for his own job prospects.
Annie Baxter there. After a punishing contract dispute and a 5-month lockout, the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra returned to the stage last night. As UNCARE reports, the first concert back was, on the surface, all about the music, but underneath, raw emotions remain.
There was an air of muted excitement as some 800 people gathered inside the Shepherd of the Valley Church in Apple Valley for the SPCO return. Mike Phillips arrived with his wife and son.
It's been a long time coming. It's good to be here.
Phillips says just as the SPCO is renewing itself, his family is renewing its subscription. Members of the crowd chatted and moved into the sanctuary. There were few indications that this was the first concert after months of acrimony and a lockout, which silenced the ensemble, considered one of the top chamber orchestras in the world. But you could find some signs. Mark Tosin and Juliet Blanca wore black armbands bearing the number 34. That's the current size of the SPCO, but the number will be reduced to 28 under the contract agreed by the musicians. Tosin choked up as he talked about what was happening.
We made black armbands because it's a real it's a real sad time to think about losing positions.
Orchestra management is offering musicians a retirement package to reduce the size of the orchestra, and Tosin worries that a large number of players will leave. There were no speeches from the stage marking the resumption of the music, just a letter in the program from St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman welcoming back audience members. Coleman is credited with brokering a deal when it looked like the rest of the season would be lost. But then the musicians took the stage and the lights went down. When concertmaster Stephen Copes walked on, the crowd rose to its feet. After a similar warm greeting for conductor Thomas Zeitmeyer, everyone settled and the music began. If the ensemble had lost any of its quality during the lockout, it was hard to tell. At intermission, Ed and Kitty Martin from Burnsville brimmed with enthusiasm.
I think they're hot to go. Hot to go.
Because what are we looking at? We're looking at an absolutely beautiful
professional group.
Encore of musicians.
Nearby, interim SPCO president Dobson West, who led management negotiations, looked on with a delighted smile on his face.
I think one of the most wonderful things about the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra is the relationship between the audience and the musicians. And it's an intimate setting, and it's wonderful music, and to be able to just reconnect the audience to the musicians is really our goal here, and and it's working beautifully, I think, tonight.
The second part of the program, featuring Schoenberg and Mozart, also proved a crowd pleaser. The standing ovation lasted for several minutes, and the musicians seemed pleased by the reception. Concertmaster Stephen Cope said it was great to be playing again, and he was amazed at how quickly the ensemble found its stride again during rehearsal. He admits, however, there is still work to do before all is well at the orchestra.
It has been very stressful for everyone, everyone in maybe a totally different way, but there's no use dwelling on it anymore. It's just we have to make the organization work better and work stronger so that this doesn't happen again.
And that, he says, will involve everyone at the SPCO.
Ewan Kerr was in Apple Valley last night. University of Minnesota Regents could approve a 5-year multi-million-dollar partnership with Fairview Health Services today. The two have been working on the agreement for more than a year, but it comes after last month's collapse of merger talks between Fairview and both Sanford Health and the University of Minnesota. Here's higher ed reporter Alex Friedrich.
The two institutions are trying to integrate operations more as part of a 5-year renewable agreement. They hope that better coordination will produce better patient care and more efficient operations. Fairview would also invest millions of dollars more into the medical school each year. Healthcare Administration Professor Dan Zismer of the U says the two parties could share in the financial gains.
That's sort of a pretty, I don't want to say standard, but not an uncommon co-management agreement.
Regents will likely give President Eric Kaler the authority to sign the agreement.
Alex Friedrich on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. The Vikings have a deal to play at the U's stadium for 2 years, and the team has even made peace between Coke and Pepsi. Tim Nelson talks about the Metrodome to new stadium transition.
It's taken a year of haggling over everything from what players can drink on the sidelines to the security deposit the Vikings have to put down on their new digs. But the deal to move the Vikings onto campus at the University of Minnesota is in place, and President Eric Kaler welcomed them to campus.
I'm delighted that we're able to partner with the Minnesota Vikings to enable the facility to be used. I think we've reached a very fair agreement to both sides. I think this is a classic example of a win-win.
The team will play at TCF Bank Stadium for the 2014 and 2015 seasons with an option for 2 more years if construction of the new stadium doesn't go as planned. The Vikings are expected to pay about $5 million annually in game day expenses, as well as another $3 million each season in rent. The team will chip in another $125,000 in cash and in-kind contributions each year to help ease the impact on surrounding businesses and residents. Lester Bagley is the team's vice president for public affairs.
We intend to have a volunteer network similar to what they have downtown Minneapolis, the Downtown Improvement District, where they have folks that are walking around and kind of telling people where to go, you know, to ensure that we are good neighbors.
And Bagley says it's a good deal.
We think it's a fair and hard-fought agreement on both sides.
Some of that fighting, it turns out, was over what fans will be drinking in the stands. The Vikings have an exclusive deal with Pepsi. The University of Minnesota has a long-term agreement that gives Coca-Cola the exclusive right to sell soft drinks on campus, right down to what Gopher football players have available on the sidelines. In the end, the two sides compromised. Gatorade, a Pepsi product, will be available to the NFL players on the sidelines, as well as for the traditional post-game Gatorade shower for the winning coach. But Coke will be the drink of choice in most of the rest of the stadium. The alcohol policy is another matter. It took a state law to get beer and wine sales into TCF Bank Stadium last year after 3 dry years at the Gophers' new football home. NFL fans will be able to imbibe as soon as the Vikings move in. Pam Wheelock is the university's vice president for university services. She says a side deal is in the works with the Regents for alcohol sales.
Wine and beer would be available in the entire facility, and then wine and beer and hard spirits would be available in the premium areas, and as well, should they have access to use the club rooms in Mariucci and Williams, that would be available there as well.
There are still some sticking points. The NFL wants a heated field, but both sides say they haven't figured out the best way to do that yet. And with 15,000 fewer seats at the U Stadium, no one can say how many Vikings fans will get tickets for game days. Plans call for bleachers on the open end of the stadium, but it's not clear whether that's a practical solution. The Vikings' home at the U is only temporary. The Metrodome is scheduled to be demolished early next year after the Vikings finish their 2013 season. Their new billion-dollar stadium is scheduled to open in 2016.
Tim Nelson there. Where will you be fishing tomorrow? The walleye season is expected to get off to a slow start. Conrad Wilson says, check ahead. Many northern Minnesota lakes are still covered with ice.
On the shores of Lake Mille Lacs, just south of Garrison, it finally feels like spring. But the lake looks more like winter.
Ice. Lots of it.
Rick Bruzewitz is a fisheries manager for the Department of Natural Resources. He says it would be difficult to get a boat in the water in most places around the lake.
You know, we've got maybe, 150 yards of open water, and that's just in front of a creek. When you go away from the creeks, in a lot of areas, it's still tight to shore even, or has 10 yards or 10 feet of open water.
Lake Mille Lacs is important to the economy in this part of central Minnesota. On a typical year, thousands of anglers launch boats into the lake for the opener, many with the hopes of emerging with the walleye for a shoreline lunch. But this is not a typical year. According to the Minnesota State Climatology Office, lakes north of the Twin Cities are approaching record late ice out dates set in 1950. Further up the Mille Lacs shoreline is Twin Pines Resort. Here the ice comes even closer to shore. The docks are still sitting in the yard, so are the boats. The temperature bounces from icy cold to summer breeze almost instantaneously, depending on whether or not the wind is blowing off the frozen lake.
Hey, Anna, I'm calling in an order for Twin Pines Resort.
Inside, resort owner Linda Eno is behind the bar ordering supplies for the season. She says usually the resort is booked solid for the weekend of the opener.
Packed. All my overnight accommodations, packed. People staying in fish houses, packed. Lines at the landing, people pulling up to my dock for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. A lot of craziness, a lot of frenzy.
This year, about 60% of the rooms are booked. She's hoping no one cancels and a few more might decide to make a last-minute trip. But with little hope for the type of fishing many are accustomed to, she knows that might not happen. To the north, the odds of casting a line into open water decrease even more. Paul Nelson is a fishing guide in Bemidji. He says if anglers don't come, it could be a lost weekend for the region's economy.
I don't know how many people are going to show up. It's outside, you know, of all of our frame of references. But if there's nowhere for them to come in the boats, I mean, are people still going to come? I would think most of them are going to delay or, I don't know. Boy, anywhere where you can get a boat in is going to be crowded.
Back at Mille Lacs, ice may not be the biggest challenge facing the lake. Test results last fall showed the lake had one of the lowest walleye populations in decades. That prompted the state and Indian bands that also fished the lake to cut in half the amount of walleye that can be caught this year. To keep sport anglers within their harvest limit, the DNR implemented stringent fishing regulations. The agency is trying to help the declining walleye population recover. At the same time, the DNR wants anglers to be able to fish without implementing catch and release midway through the season. Some resort owners say that would be devastating for business, but it could happen if the state reaches its walleye limit. Terry McCoyd owns McCoyd's Inn near Isle. Earlier this week, he was finishing up construction on several new docks. He says the late start could help sustain the fish population and extend the season on Mille Lacs.
Actually, with this late ice out, it's probably going to be the best thing that we could have.
McCoyd says bookings are a little down for this weekend, but the rest of the season is shaping up to be a good one. Plus, he says, the fact that there's still ice on the lake is history in the making.
It'll be something special. You can tell your grandkids about it later on.
The 2013 walleye season starts just after midnight. Conrad Wilson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Isle.
Conrad Wilson, based in St. Cloud. I'm Phil Picardi here in St. Paul. Glad to have you along for the NPR News update on this Friday, May the 10th. I'm Phil Picardi. I'll be back next week with more Minnesota news on your schedule.